Colonel Neil relates.
At the beginning of the year, there had been the disastrous first hurricane campaign, and I suppose it was that the authorities in GHQ Delhi had reckoned they must grasp at any straw that was going, and they made much out of Wingate's expedition. In my view, probably only number three column on a Mike Calvert had achieved anything of significance on that expedition. So I was pleased later on, for their sakes, there had been some publicity in the Indian newspapers. But for ourselves, I thought it was just a joke. I can't remember quite how long we were in the hospital. A week, no more. Anyway, we were all pronounced fit and well. And Tag and I said our au revoirs. He went off to 142 Company Rear Party, who were still in foul. And I went off with my men to 32nd Rear Party, which was in a house quite close by, as far as I can remember. And then after a few days, we were off by road and rail to Dehradun, which is our regimental headquarters. When I got to a rear party in Fowl, the OC rear party was one of our own officers, Captain Ronnie Green. He told me that my party was the very, very last party to escape from Burma, no others expected. And all the others had got out long before. In fact, some parties started crossing the River Chindwin in April, as far as I know. Anyway, eventually we got back by road and rail to our home in Dera, and I found that the whole battalion had gone on leave, and that the Canadian, Mac McKenzie, who I mentioned early on in my talk, was the only member of the battalion present. So I tried to find out from the orderly room of our regimental centre if there had been any information at all about my missing men, and I couldn't get any news at all of them. All they could say was those who had come to us from the 10th Gurkhas and who had already arrived back with the battalion in Dehradun had gone on leave, and from there most of them would elect to go back to their own regiments. So I was never, ever able to see my men who went, again, who had gone missing at Sartar. I was very sad about that. I myself, so I was told, had been posted missing. But fortunately, no one had as yet sent any news to my mother, and I know she'd have been very upset that she'd been sent such a telegram. Anyway, all was well that ended well. And we all went off, Mac and I should say, on a month's leave to Srinagar, where we lived in style on a houseboat, overate and overdrank, and I spent all the silver rupees I'd carried out of Burma drinking the king's health. And yes, it was there when I was in Srinagar on leave that I got my first of 20-plus bouts of malaria. And they persisted for a long time after I returned from leave, and we were waiting for the town to collect in Dehradun before going off to the jungles of southern India to join the 25th Indian Division prior to taking part in the third and final Arakan campaign of 1944-1945, but that's another story, of course. Fortunately, my malaria didn't prevent me continuing sobering. I was told at some stage after I got back to India that anyone who had gone down more than 11 times with malaria was usually invalided back to the UK. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but this is the story that came to my ears. So I purposely didn't tell anyone that I had got malaria. How this was not discovered, I don't know, because when I got back to their room and I got these remaining bouts of malaria, I was absolutely flattened. I would be unable to go on parade. I just lay on my bed in the veranda in the quarter in which I was living. Even with hot sun playing on me and wrapped up in a blanket, I was still shaking like a man with ague. I suppose someone must have told the CO I was sick, but whether they'd said I got malaria or not, I don't know. I got away with it and I was never discovered, but it was a very unpleasant period. The 3rd Battalion as a whole had taken some very heavy casualties during the first Chinook expedition. We'd lost our CO, Colonel Alex, and the intelligence officer, George Delarue. They'd both been killed during number one column's retreat from the Irrawaddy. Philip Conran, who had been sacked by Wingate as OC4 column, had been killed or died in some way or other recrossing the Irrawaddy. I'm not sure whether he drowned or whether he was attacked by Burma Traitor Army people, but die he did, and no one really knows quite how he was killed or died. Another officer was also lost, Captain Vivian Weatherall of One Column. He died very gallantly on the Swale River, trying to rescue some of his soldiers who were wounded. And some 290-plus Gurkha other ranks and followers were killed in action, or died as prisoners of war, or died of starvation, which was quite a heavy blow to fall on a single battalion. Now, my story is nearly getting to its end, you'll be glad to know, but I'd like, before I finish, give you my assessment of the Japanese soldier based on the 1943 campaign and subsequent in 44 and 45. What I wrote at the end of my long story about the Chindon expedition is this. The Japanese produced in the last war some of the bravest and most effective fighting men in military legend. And for these manly qualities, I later came to admire and respect them greatly. However, throughout the battlefields of Asia and the islands of the Southwest Pacific, these same Japanese samurai brought on total grief to thousands of Allied soldiers and their relatives and to the civilians of those countries which they overran, particularly to those who were unfortunate enough to become their prisoners of war. The atrocities that they committed against others have been well documented. And it was because of such dreadful acts that many men who fought against Japan, including myself, can never forget or forgive. Those of us who hold such views were both disgusted and furious at our government, but it insisted on sending a senior member of our royal family to attend the funeral of the late Emperor Hirohito. It is my belief that he was just as much a war criminal as many of his field commanders, who were subsequently tried and put to death. His soldiers did what they did in his name. He should, therefore, have also been tried at the end of the war and put up against the wall and shot. Let me say, if I may, what my assessment of Wingate's first Chinook expedition was. It's purely my opinion. Mine alone. What did I learn in general from this traumatic expedition? First and foremost, I learnt that Lord Wingate's overall conception of the operation was sound and daring. To dare in war is to win, more often than not. However, unless the training for an operation such as one committed to deep penetration behind a formidable enemy's lines is sound and equally important, unless it is its execution is robust and effective, that operation will not totally succeed. In order to penetrate successfully behind such an enemy's lines whilst retaining morale the whole while, two things stand out of importance in my view. First, arrangements for casualty evacuation must be sound and believed to be sound in the minds of all troops taking part. Secondly, radio communications must go down to section level. In our case, there was only one radio per column, some 300 men in strength. Furthermore, when operating as deep inside enemy territory as we were required to do, I do not consider it to be sound infantry tactics to split up a force into small groups. Wingate's aim in retreating to India from the far bank of the Irrawaddy in small parties was to enable groups to live off the land. Instead, in my firm opinion, he should have ordered his force to return in column, or even two column groups, complete with their radio communications. Such groups could have then called for supplies by air whenever the tactical situation allowed, and posed such a potent fighting force that the Japs would have been unable, in the time available to them, to gather together sufficiently large forces in order to attack us, prevent our escape. Once we'd split into our small parties, we were at once fair game for the Jap hunting parties of a platoon strength or so, on a platoon or so in strength. I have said that Wingate's overall plan was sound. But I considered at the time, and this view has not changed one bit over the intervening years, that his failure to train his troops in immediate and aggressive contact drills led to numerous and unnecessary deaths in the force. He also went too far. By crossing the Irrawaddy, he stretched himself dangerously. His achievements beyond that river were negligible, and a great number of casualties were incurred as a direct result of our having too long a retreat route. However, having decided to go as far as he did, and then having made up his mind that his men were to return in penny packets, feeding themselves en route, he was negligent in the extreme in not requesting a more adequate supply of maps and compasses in the final airdrop. I cannot speak for other groups, but Tag and I had only three incomplete sets of maps and three compasses in the whole of our party when we split from the 8th column. When we were split up again at Tsar Tower, Sergeant Almaday and my main body of Gurkhas had not got a map or compass between them. This was no way for a deep penetration operation to be conducted. As mentioned earlier in my story, my own column never executed a single aggressive maneuver the whole time I was with it, and I have often wondered why we were required to go so far for so little. Sure enough, Wingate's brigade did indeed prove that a relatively large force could be maintained for quite a long while behind enemy lines by the use of the then new method of air supply. That was the most significant thing to prove, beyond any doubt at all. Some columns, of course, were aggressive, and achieved some limited success in killing a certain number of enemy soldiers and destroying some of his railway bridges, all of which were soon repaired and in use again. The above last mentioned points were the only achievements, in my mind, of Wingate's expedition in 1943, but they were exclusively achieved at a great cost to the force as a whole. Credit, of course, must be given where credit is due, but criticism must also be made when that is due. First, I believe that for a hazardous operation such as ours, pitted against renowned enemies such as the Japanese, those in authority in the army in India were culpable in selecting an officer from a supporting arm to command what was essentially an infantry formation about to be launched in the holy infantry operation. Wingate, of course, was a gunner officer. There should be horses for courses, as they say. Secondly, Wingate was culpable. In respect to the Gurkha columns, in placing officers from British units to command Gurkha soldiers in battle, who had never had any experience with such soldiers previously, and who had no knowledge whatsoever of their men's language or customs. Higher authority was not responsible for this, Wingate was. Finally, Wingate ruled very often by fear. For this reason, I believe his column commanders did not query the appalling and disgraceful order he issued while we were crossing the Chindran on 14 February. Namely, that wounded men who were unable to march were to be left behind in the nearest village. Such an order was absolutely wrong. Both battalion and column commanders should have queried this order, even at the risk of jeopardizing their future military careers. I consider that they were being disloyal to their troops. I consider that they were being disloyal to their troops by not doing so. Particularly as they were well aware of the coming dangers we were to face and the reputation of the Jap soldiers had for their treatment of prisoners. What did I learn in particular from the first Chindit expedition?
Overall, I did more in this frightening operation than I did during the remainder of my combat career. These lessons, too long and too many to list in detail at the end of an already long story, affected the whole of my future life as an infantry soldier, and they also affected, in particular, how I trained myself and my men for future operations of every kind. Everything I learnt, except one thing, came as a result of my own mistakes and the mistakes of others. That one exception was fear. All soldiers will know about fear from time to time, and it is essential that they should do so. It is part and parcel of their military education, and it is not taught at schools of instruction. The fear about which I learnt was not the usual momentary kind, such as that known during a dangerous firefight or an attack. This was a long, drawn-out experience, lasting not for moments, hours, days, or weeks. My fear lasted for months. And I believe that it was because of this its very duration that I found eventually, and surprisingly, it became so beneficial to me in the future. After Thar Tower, when we had become a tiny group, and I quickly came to know that I would soon become a very bad influence on everyone in the party, particularly my Gurkhas, if I allowed my own fear to be displayed. I was a youngster, and I found disguising my fear very hard to effect. It was clear to me why I must hide this feeling from my men. A commander is useless if his own fear is allowed to be translated to the troops he commands. It was pure pride, however, which made me try to hide such feelings from Tag. I've often wondered, since those days, whether or not my efforts to disguise my fear had been successful. The lessons that I learned from mistakes were equally beneficial. First of all, the expedition as a whole taught me the requirement to operate maximum strength, except during reconnaissance, when taking part in deep penetration operations. Secondly, the ambushing of our group at Thar Tower taught me the importance of learning as an effective counter-ambush drill. Had I, myself, been taught such a drill during training in the Sorgh jungles in 1942, I know that I could have rolled up that relatively small party of Jap ambushers with very few casualties on our part. I would have then had my command complete and not split up. Thirdly, the difficulties I experienced map reading across country in order to avoid villages and tracks after that ambush encounter made me realize with a vengeance the necessity for all junior leaders to become totally proficient in navigation in difficult hill jungle, where compass bearings cannot be easily taken in order to help fix a current position. Finally, the head-on contact with the Jap elephant patrol in the Metcalfe track taught me this. The leading elements of an infantry group, including the leading commanders, must train in order to produce a lightning-like response to any contact, and all such men's weapons must be carried ready to fire at a moment's notice, neither slung from the shoulder nor safety catches applied. Despite my physical exhaustion at the time of that particular contact, had I been trained to be more alert and had my Tommy gun been held ready to fire, I could have knocked out that Jap officer in the white helmet out of his hide beyond any doubt. This is a shame that lives with me to this day and will last forever. I had missed my one good chance of killing my first Jap. I never forgot this lesson. Subsequently, I practiced and practiced at every opportunity, quick reaction and the immediate and accurate use of my weapon, whether rifle or submachine gun. And from that day on to the end of my service, every enemy seen within range was fired at, and every man fired at died. I taught my soldiers to do the same. Together we rehearsed, practiced the close-quarter battle drills I later taught myself over and over again until they became second nature to us. During the rest of the war in Burma, then in Malaya, and finally in Borneo, these drills, accurate navigation skills, together with those lessons learned from that deep penetration operation in 1943 were all put to devastating effect by our soldiers of the 3rd and 2nd Battalions. Before I conclude the above paragraphs concerning lessons learned, I must return briefly to the subject of fear. Awful though fear is when it is experienced, when it is conquered, it can later become truly beneficial to military men. On being placed in a position where one is able to see fear in others, provided one has known it oneself, the commander can soon learn how to detect fear, and with practice, he will learn how far he can push his men, so affected in battle. A commander who is unable to do this, either because he has not known fear himself, or because he is unable to recognize it in others, may become worse than useless. Very often I have found that a commander brave and dashing in himself, who cannot appreciate genuine fear in his men, is apt to push his soldiers too hard at the wrong moment, when catastrophe could well result. Such a commander can well be worse for his men than one who is, perhaps, fearful himself and can therefore recognize his frailty in his men, and can ensure against it becoming disastrous by correct handling at the crucial moment. If such a commander can bring himself to lead from the front at the same time as conquering his own dreads, there is probably nothing that he cannot achieve in war. My final words of this long story must be for those young men from Nepal who have become the soldiers of my very first command in war. As already explained, they were mainly of a draft from the 10th Gurkhas. Sadly, the majority of them were separated from me by fate early on during our long retreat. I never saw them again as that party retreat returned, in fact, to Dehradun, ahead of my smaller group. They had already gone back to their villages on leave when I reached Dehradun, and they returned to their own regiments afterwards. I was therefore never able to thank them or say goodbye to them. I've always been very sad about this. To them all, I owe a very great debt of thanks. Excuse me. Very great debt of thanks for what they did, unknowingly perhaps. They taught me about girls, how to know them and how to command them, and I will never forget this. But perhaps my greatest debt must be to Havilah Budiman and those few young men who followed me from Thartar to Fremantle. They showed Tag and me what we could eat from the jungle when we had nothing else. They showed me in particular what real loyalty can be. Never once did they query an order. Never once did they question my decision to take them west to the Chingwin to escape. They smiled and grinned at me in adversity. They knew well that my knowledge of military matters was very limited. Nevertheless, they always accepted my authority. Gurkhas are always at their best and do their best under a commander they know well. I was a total stranger to these young men when fate first threw us together in the new alliance of Guna. Nonetheless, from the beginning to the end of our retreat, as Gurkhas always do, they were prepared to follow a young British officer through hell and high water in order to do the bidding of the English king who lived far away across the sea. To these particular young men, my first command, I give my greatest thanks.